Picture this. You're sitting in this really cramped, completely unventilated room in London.
Right, and it's pitch black in there.
Pitch black. And it's the dead of winter, early 1970s. You are crammed into this space with maybe, I don't know, 60 other people.
And there's no intermission, right?
No intermission at all. The doors are shut tight.
Yeah.
You are essentially trapped in this tiny box for the duration.
Which sounds a bit terrifying, honestly.
It really does. But then, out of the dark, this man steps into a single solitary spotlight. And he's wearing a corset, fishnet stockings, heavy makeup, and he is just belting out at the top of his lungs that he is a sweet transvestite from outer space.
It's just, I mean, it's a completely disorienting experience.
Totally disorienting.
Yeah.
You know, you came expecting a standard stage play, but within 5 minutes, that polite, passive theatrical experience you're used to is just completely dismantled.
Yeah, you are wading into the absolute definition of creative muddy waters.
Exactly. There is zero roadmap for what you're about to watch.
It was a total rejection of the theatrical establishment, like
Yep.
completely uncharted territory for a stage show.
And that feeling, that sense of being totally blindsided, is exactly what we are chasing in today's deep dive.
Yeah.
We are pulling from a massive stack of notes today, all based on the incredibly comprehensive Wikipedia article on the Rocky Horror Show.
A legendary piece of art.
Truly. And our mission today is to look at the mechanics of how this weird, unapologetically campy tribute to low-budget B-movies somehow bypassed every traditional gatekeeper to become a massive global cultural juggernaut.
And when we say juggernaut, we mean seen by over 30 million people.
30 million. Translated into 20 different languages.
Right.
It's a show that fundamentally altered how audiences even interact with art.
What's fascinating here is the statistical improbability of those numbers. It's staggering when you look at it.
Oh, completely.
Because you really have to remember the origin story here. If we look at the source material, the creator, Richard O'Brien, he wasn't some seasoned Broadway producer.
No, not at all.
He was an out-of-work actor in London. He was totally broke. And he just had a lot of time on his hands during those long, dark winter evenings. He wrote this simply to pass the time.
Just a winter hobby, basically.
Right. It was a fringe experiment that was never, ever engineered to be a mainstream hit.
Okay, so I'm looking at these early notes, and I actually have to push back just a little on that whole, like, accidental geniuses narrative.
Oh, how so? Well, I mean, you don't accidentally write a show with such perfectly timed themes and hyper-specific cultural touchstones without knowing exactly what buttons you're pushing.
That's fair.
O'Brien didn't just throw darts at a board. You know,
Right.
he built a very deliberate mechanism. It's almost like he made a mixtape of his wildest obsessions.
A mixtape is a great way to put it.
Right. He took old 1930s B-horror movies, 1950s rock and roll, those old Steve Reeves muscle man films, and then he infused it all with this transgressive sexual politics, heavy doses of transvestism, and just weaponized it for the stage. Okay, yeah, that is a very fair challenge. The synthesis of all those elements was definitely deliberate, even if the massive scale of the success totally caught him off guard.
Yeah, the scale was a surprise.
And you really have to look at the cultural timing of it all. O'Brien built this deliberate mechanism right in the middle of the British glam rock era.
Oh, right, like David Bowie and Mark Bolan.
Exactly. They were already blurring gender lines in pop music at that time.
Yeah.
And O'Brien has actually noted in the sources that glam rock provided the cultural catalyst, like a permission structure that allowed him to, quote, be myself more.
Huh. So it was like the exact right soil for this very weird seed to grow.
Perfectly said.
But man, the soil was physically tiny. Like we mentioned, that premiere in June 1973, staged by an Australian director named Jim Sharman, who was at the theater upstairs at the Royal Court in London. And it literally only had 63 seats.
Barely bigger than a living room.
Seriously.
Yeah.
But what happened to those 63 seats really came down to some incredibly calculated choices by the cast. I mean, let's look at Tim Curry.
Yes, universally recognized as the definitive Dr. Frankenfurter.
Absolutely. And the sources say Curry actually met O'Brien on the street outside a gym. O'Brien was just scouting for a muscular guy who could sing, and they bump into each other.
Talk about being in the right place at the right time.
Right. So Curry gets cast, and he makes this vocal choice that essentially cemented the entire legacy of the show. I mean, did they know what they had, or was this a total shot in the dark?
Well, the accent was a very specific genius choice. During rehearsals, Tim Curry decided that Frankenfurter shouldn't just sound like a typical street-level drag queen.
Okay.
He decided the character needed to speak with the extravagant, highly refined, posh accent of the Queen of the United Kingdom.
Wait, literally the Queen's accent.
Literally the Queen.
That juxtaposition is just a masterclass in theatrical friction. I mean, you have this hypersexualized, chaotic alien running around in lingerie, but he's speaking with the absolute pinnacle of rigid, royal British pronunciation.
Right. It creates this intense cognitive dissonance for the audience.
You can't look away. Your brain is actively trying to reconcile the visual of a corseted alien with the auditory input of high-class royalty.
And it forces the audience to really pay attention. It elevates the camp to something resembling high art, honestly.
Yeah.
It wasn't just cheap shock value. It had a refined satirical edge to it.
That's such a good point.
And that specific mechanical choice by Curry is a huge reason the show was an immediate critical smash. It actually won the 1973 Evening Standard Award for Best Musical.
Which, winning Best Musical is just wild when you actually break down what happens on that stage.
It really is.
Look, everyone listening has likely been to a wedding or a Halloween party and danced to the Time Warp. We all know the song. We all know the pelvic thrust.
It's ingrained in our culture.
But the sources reveal how deceptive that song is as an entry point. Because immediately after that fun, super catchy dance number, the plot just descends into some genuinely dark, absurd places.
The contrast is severe, to say the least. I mean, you start with Brad and Janet. They are this squeaky clean, stereotypical, highly conservative 1950s American couple.
Right, the prom king and queen type.
Exactly. They get a flat tire, stumble into this gothic castle. Frank Enfurter introduces himself, unveils his artificially created, physically perfect muscle man named Rocky. And then, yeah, the fun dance numbers just give way to absolute carnage.
Total carnage.
Yeah.
I mean, Frankenfurter literally murders his ex-lover.
Right, Eddie.
Yeah, Eddie, who is a brain-damaged zombie biker.
Yeah.
And he murders him with an axe.
On stage.
On stage. He hacks him to death, stucks his corpse into a Coca-Cola freezer, and literally serves him to the guests for dinner.
It's so dark.
And by the end of it all, Frank has forced these squeaky clean visitors, Brad and Janet, to perform a floor show in front of an audience clad in absolutely nothing but lingerie. It is this magnetic, outrageous energy.
Which brings up a fascinating contradiction in the show's history, because it was a massive hit in the UK, obviously. It eventually ran for nearly 3,000 performances in London.
Wow, 3,000.
And then it transferred to Los Angeles and had a hugely successful 9-month run there, too.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Because I'm looking at the numbers for the 1975 Broadway debut, and it makes absolutely no sense.
It's a sharp pivot.
It ran for 9 months in LA, and then it bombed in New York in just 45 days. I mean, how does the hottest ticket in the world flatline on Broadway? Did the New York audience just smell a corporate cash grab?
They absolutely smelled the corporate machinery. If we look at the source text, it points directly to the American producer Lou Adler.
Okay, what did he do?
He fundamentally misunderstood the mechanism of the show. Adler pushed the Broadway run primarily as a massive public vehicle to launch the upcoming 1975 film adaptation.
Oh, so it was just marketing for the movie.
Exactly. He treated the stage production as this glossy corporate stepping stone. He was even comparing it in the marketing to massive polished shows like Jesus Christ Superstar.
Oh, wow. That is a terrible comparison. It's like taking a gritty dive bar punk band and forcing them to play under the fluorescent lights of a corporate shareholder meeting.
That's a great analogy.
Right. The friction and the danger that makes them cool in a basement makes them look completely ridiculous and out of place when you try to sanitize it for a mass market, wealthy Broadway crowd.
Completely. The show thrived in that 1970s authenticity economy. It needed to feel like an underground, interactive, almost dangerous fringe experience.
Yeah, the moment you drag it out of the counterculture and package it as mainstream entertainment, it loses its teeth. Broadway audiences expect to sit back and be entertained by a polished product. But Rocky Horror requires you to be complicit in the messiness.
It demands interaction.
Exactly. But the beauty of this piece of art is that while Broadway rejected it, the rest of the world absorbed it and mutated it.
Yes, the global tours.
Looking through these global tours reveals a lot about how different cultures process radical art. Because a traditional musical, say, the sound of music has a fixed script. The blocking is set. The dialogue is locked. The sets are identical whether you're in Tokyo or Toronto.
Very rigid.
But Rocky Horror acted more like a cultural chameleon. It had to mutate to trigger the same shock value in different regions.
And the adaptations took massive, massive liberties to ensure the show resonated locally. For example, in Brazil in 1975, the local audiences just didn't have the same nostalgic connection to 1930s Hollywood B-movies.
Oh, sure. The cultural touchstones were different.
Right. So during the opening, there's that famous lyric asking, "Whatever happened to Fay Wray?" referencing the actress from King Kong.
Yeah.
That would have fallen totally flat in Brazil, so they entirely swapped it out to reference the local samba legend, Carmen Miranda.
That is so smart. And the 1980 German production took the mutation even further. The director, Walter Bachmeier, he looked at the traditional Gothic castle setting, decided it was way too traditional, and just threw it out entirely.
Threw out the castle.
Yep. He set the entire show in a sterile hospital instead.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that production is also historically notable because it featured the first black actor to ever play Frankenfurter, an American guest star named Coven C. Washington.
That's incredible. The show constantly reinvented itself based on the specific cultural anxieties and norms of wherever it landed. And sometimes the reinvention was completely physical and accidental.
Oh, like the 1975 original Melbourne run in Australia.
Yeah.
Love this anecdote in the notes.
So good.
So during the song The Sword of Damocles, the actor playing Rocky is swinging on a ladder and he loses his grip and literally falls off the ladder mid-scene.
It's a complete disaster.
Right. But the resident stage director doesn't stop the show. He just grabs the understudy, a guy named Clive Blackie, shoves him under the stage, and yells, "This is your big chance. You're on."
And he just went for it.
Yeah, Blackie just finishes the song and takes over the role from that moment forward.
That is the chaotic energy of the narrative literally bleeding into the real-world production. But, you know, if we connect this to the bigger picture, we really have to acknowledge that the global journey wasn't just quirky lyric changes and fun stage mishaps.
Oh, it got very serious.
The show faced severe, highly organized resistance globally.
Right. And before we dig into that resistance, I just want to pause and say, looking at these historical notes, purely from an objective standpoint, the sheer political polarization this show caused is staggering.
It really is.
And I want to be clear to you listening. It's not our job today to debate the politics of the 1970s. We're not taking sides here, left or right. We are just impartially reporting the facts from our sources to show how a weird little musical became a literal target for government censorship and violence.
Exactly. And the pushback was intense because the themes were deeply threatening to conservative, authoritarian societies at the time. Look at Spain in 1974. The country was still under the Franco regime.
A very strict environment.
Very. The censors actually forced the production to tone down the profanity and alter the characters' names. But even heavily censored, the core of the show, the fluid sexuality, the total rejection of traditional authority was viewed as a direct personal attack on the regime's strict moral codes.
Wow.
It was so controversial that it was restricted to an adults-only event playing at 1 point a.m.
At 1 a.m. And yet, it continually played to standing room-only crowds. I mean, people were risking a lot just to be in that room.
They really were.
And the stakes were even higher in Argentina in 1975. So they opened the show at a cabaret-style venue in Buenos Aires. And just days after the premiere, unknown assailants threw a literal Molotov cocktail at the theater.
A firebomb over a musical.
The literal firebomb. And the source material attributes this violence to the AAA, which was a right-wing death squad that employed violent tactics against suspected dissidents. The threats of the political persecution were so severe that the entire theater company just had to disband.
Think about the sociological mechanism at play there. I mean, why does an authoritarian death squad care about a campy musical?
Right, it seems ridiculous on the surface.
Because authoritarian regimes rely on strict gender and moral binaries to maintain order and control. So a piece of art that actively celebrates the blurring of those lines, that makes a mockery of traditional conservative couples like Brad and Janet, it isn't just seen as offensive. It is viewed as a literal destabilizing threat to state control.
Which perfectly explains a massive piece of the Rocky horror puzzle that we actually haven't even touched on yet, but that every single person listening knows about.
The audience participation.
Yes, the shadow casts, the callbacks, throwing toast at the stage, yelling insults at Brad and Janet. This wasn't just people being obnoxious in a theater. When you look at how much authoritarian regimes feared this show, the audience's deep need to talk back makes perfect psychological sense.
It is the ultimate rejection of passive consumption. When an audience member yells a callback at the stage, they are breaking the fourth wall and reclaiming the narrative space.
They're part of the show.
Right. In the 1970s, marginalized groups were largely dictated to by mainstream society. Rocky Horror provided a framework where the audience could literally rewrite the script in real time. They weren't just watching a show about liberation, they were actively practicing it by taking over the audio environment of the theater.
It's the authenticity economy in its purest form. They're participating in the art. And, you know, that challenge to identity, that active participation, is exactly what tore critics apart back in the day.
Oh, the critics were ruthless.
You look at the sources, and there is this brutally dismissive quote from a New York critic named Rex Reed. After seeing the show, he publicly claimed that the production, quote, was only for homosexuals.
Wow.
Yeah. He basically tried to box it into a marginalized corner to strip it of its broader cultural power.
And Richard O'Brien offered a really vital counterpoint to that kind of gatekeeping. O'Brien stated that the show is fundamentally a celebration of difference.
A celebration of difference. I like that.
It was engineered as a space that allows marginalized communities to gather, to coexist, and to feel seen without having to explain themselves to anybody. This was one of the first popular musicals to openly depict fluid sexuality during a highly divided era where that kind of representation was incredibly scarce.
The show basically became a sanctuary. But what I find so compelling in these notes is how that sanctuary sort of ebbs and flows depending on the anxiety level of the culture around it. Like, its success acts as a barometer for the cultural climate.
The Broadway revival in the year 2000 is a perfect example of that barometer.
Oh, yeah, the 2000 run.
It was doing reasonably well, and then 9/11 happened. And the cultural shift post-9/11 was massive. Audiences were suddenly seeking comfort, certainty, and very traditional heroism.
That makes sense.
The subversive, cynical, chaotic nature of Rocky Horror suddenly felt wildly out of step with the national mood. Daphne Ruben Vega, the actress playing Magenta in that run, noted that the audiences simply vanished.
Just disappeared overnight.
Basically. She said the theater went from a full house to practically two people, forcing the show to close early due to massive financial losses.
Wow. It's like when the real world feels dangerously chaotic, people don't want to buy a ticket to watch chaotic aliens dismantle societal norms. They want the petting zoo, you know, not the wild animal.
Exactly.
But the incredible resilience of this show is that it continually waits for the culture to catch back up. Our sources highlight a 2023 production at the Central Square Theater in Boston that deliberately tapped back into that original 1970s friction.
Bringing it back to its roots.
Yes. To celebrate the 50th anniversary, they put together a production entirely helmed by a transgender and non-binary team.
And the co-director of that production explicitly stated their goal was to bring the show back to those roots. They wanted to make it as transgressive, radical, and genuinely shocking for a modern audience as the original production was for that 63-seat crowd back in London in 1973.
And the commercial machine is fully geared up again, too. There's a massive Broadway revival slated for 2026, starring Luke Evans as Frankenfurter.
It just keeps coming back.
It has survived flops, firebombs, massive cultural shifts, and intense censorship, and it just absolutely refuses to fade into obscurity.
Because beneath the corsets, the B-movie tropes, and all the audience callbacks, the show taps into an undeniable universal human urge.
Which is what?
The urge to strip away the expectations that society layers on top of you, sometimes literally stripping them away down to your underwear and to just exist for a couple hours entirely free of judgment.
So we've traced this incredible arc today. From Richard O'Brien writing in his apartment just to pass the time, to Tim Curry's posh accent elevating the camp, to a disastrous corporate Broadway flop.
A very bumpy road.
We've seen it mutate in Brazil and Germany, survive right-wing death squads in Argentina, pioneer the concept of interactive audience shadow casts, and become a 50-year sanctuary for misfits everywhere.
It is the ultimate case study in the power and resilience of fringe art.
But, you know, there's a twist at the very end of this musical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a detail in the sources that fundamentally changes how you process everything we've just talked about. So what does this all mean?
Well, it's a brilliantly subversive ending that frequently gets overlooked, mostly because audiences are just so exhausted from the dancing and the yelling by that point.
Right.
But you have this entire narrative built on themes of liberation. The characters experience complete sexual freedom. They belt out the show's massive anthem, "Don't Dream It, Be It."
A hugely uplifting message.
And then the rug is completely pulled out from under them.
Frankenfurter is killed.
Mm.
The remaining aliens pack up the Gothic castle and literally blast off back into outer space.
Yeah.
And Brad and Janet, these two people who have had their entire worldview dismantled and their identities permanently altered, are just left behind.
Just abandoned.
They're standing in the smoking rubble, completely traumatized and confused.
And instead of a soaring, uplifting musical finale to send the audience home happy, the narrator steps out onto the stage.
Yeah.
And he delivers this deeply cynical, bleak, existential sci-fi monologue. His final words to the audience are, "Crawling on the planet's face, insects called the human race, lost in time and lost in space and meaning."
It gives me chills every time I read it. And that is exactly what I want to leave you with today. For a show that has spent half a century famous worldwide for celebrating pleasure, identity, and the radical joy of living your truth, why does O'Brien end it on such a tiny, meaningless, existentially terrifying note?
It's a huge question.
Is the ultimate mechanical message of the Rocky Horror Show that because we are all just tiny insects crawling on a rock completely lost in the vastness of space, we might as well just enjoy the floor show while we're here?
It is a profound, unsettling paradox, and it's exactly why people keep going back into that dark room.
A dark room where you get to yell at the stage and rewrite the rules. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep looking at the mechanisms behind the art, and we'll see you next time.